Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
You know, I spent days, ladies and gentlemen, trying to figure out how to do a 15-minute segment on the phone book. Just couldn't do it. So that's why I'm not NPR. But not only that, I'm not Christine O'Donnell either. You know that the Republican candidate for Senate in Delaware has a new TV commercial that broke this week in which she proclaims, "I'm you." I don't know if she's ever seen J. Edgar or heard it, but she says, "I'm you." Well, I'm not you. Because if I were you, I'd be listening and I could take the rest of the hour off. See what I'm saying? So I'm unfortunately me. I'm stuck with me. If I were you, you know, I'd go vote for me. But I'm not running because I'm me. If I were you, I'd be listening to me, but I'm me. So that's all I can say about that subject because I'm me. If I were you, I could say more about it. Like, stop talking about you, but I'm not. I'm talking about me. Ladies and gentlemen, the British government, which is fixing to engage in an awful lot of cuts in government spending, they're going to come out with the full report pretty darn sudden. And the person who is leading the review of the financial state of higher education in Great Britain, any guesses? Well, I'll give you his name. That won't help. Lord Brown. What can Lord Brown do for you? Okay. But Lord Brown, who is he? Quick. Less quickly. More slowly now. Former chairman of BP. How could it be a British company? How could we be so stupid as to think that's a British company? Lord Brown running the spending review in higher education because he used to run BP. Well, get rid of the banisters on staircases. That'll save money. I don't know if that'll be in his suggestion, but what do I know? I'm me. Ladies and gentlemen, I know. I can just keep that up for the whole hour. That'll be entertaining. The buried lead department reports in as we enter the news of attack. The Washington Post leads in this story with the news that Taliban representatives and the government of Afghan President Karzai have begun secret high-level talks over a negotiated end to the war. The talks follow inconclusive meetings hosted by Saudi Arabia more than a year ago. The current discussions are preliminary. The sources say for the first time they believe Taliban representatives are fully authorized to speak for the Afghan Taliban organization based in Pakistan and its leader, Mullah Omar. Mullah to you. And to me, because I'm you. They are very, very serious about finding a way out, says one source close to the talks. All right, that's the lead. Here's buried way down. Down with the Chilean miners in the depth of the story is this. But one Afghan source, reflecting tension between the two governments, said Pakistan's insistence on a central role in any negotiations has made talks difficult, even within that Quetta Shura, the part of the Taliban based in the southwestern Pakistani province of Baluchistan. Quote, they try to keep very tight control, the source said of the Pakistanis. So it's, you know, it's okay for the U.S. or for President Karzai to be talking to the Taliban. But apparently we won't get a resolution unless the Pakistanis have, quote, very tight control. It's our friends. Why wouldn't they have? Why wouldn't they want? Speaking of which, the head of Pakistan's military has ordered an investigation into a video circulating on the Internet that depicts that country's soldiers executing blindfolded men in civilian clothing, according to senior Pakistani officials. General Ashfaq Kayani appointed a two-star general to determine the identity of the uniformed personnel and the veracity of the video footage, and he pledged to take the strictest possible disciplinary action if warranted. The video appeared several months ago on insurgent websites, but it surfaced last week on YouTube. It shows a group of soldiers firing at a row of six men in traditional Pakistani clothing whose eyes are covered and whose hands are secured behind their backs. The men fall to the ground, and one soldier walks up to the bodies and delivers coup de grace. Pakistan initially denounced the video as a fake, suggesting it was manufactured to malign the military. But the U.S. administration and military officials have urged action. And also about our friend Pakistan, just to complete the trifecta. Perv Musharraf, I call him Perv. Pervez to you. He's the former president of Pakistan, as you know. Of course, he took that job in a military coup. He admits now that Pakistan has trained militant groups, i.e. terrorists, to fight against India, and, quote, the government turned a blind eye because they wanted India to discuss Kashmir. This is in an interview with Der Spiegel. Was he running for president of Germany? General Musharraf said militant groups were indeed formed to fight India and Kashmir. The West was ignoring the resolution of the Kashmir issue, which is the core issue of Pakistan. Well, all right then. Now we know. See? We thought they were concerned about, you know, terrorism in Afghanistan. Kashmir is the core issue of Pakistan. They'll train terrorists, militants, to deal with that. Quote, we expected the West, especially the United States and important countries like Germany, to resolve the Kashmir issue. Has Germany done that? Perv, you don't want Germany to resolve territorial issues. Take it from me. Or don't. Take it from Christine O'Donnell, because she's me. And, of course, he is complaining that the West blames Pakistan for everything. Everybody's interested in strategic deals with India, but Pakistan is always seen as the rogue. He did strongly criticize A.Q. Khan, the father of the nuclear bomb in Pakistan, calling him a characterless man. All right, if we can make him a bodiless man, too, we're ahead of the curve. And I'm hello. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Bulldog.
And even though they won't allow Beatles songs to be sold on iTunes, YouTube is your friend. From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And are you listening to me on HD radio? Come on now. Fess up. Somebody must. No, nobody must be. The FCC Media Bureau Audio Division Chief, Peter Doyle, was speaking at the Future of Music Policy Summit this week in Washington, D.C. He said only about 150 stations out of all the radio stations in the United States, 12,000, only 150 have notified the FCC of their interest in increasing power for their HD radio signals. There had been talk that the reason more people didn't listen to HD radio was because it needed more power for the digital signal than the analog signal. That's one of the improvements. It needs more power. That's got to be good for the environment, no? Anyway, the Media Bureau in January adopted an order that allows most stations to increase their HD power. And by the way, the initials HD, like the initials NPR, stand for nothing. It's not high definition. It's just, it's like high definition toast. Ooh, it's got to be better. It's HD. Okay, then. To increase their HD power levels by 6 dB, dBs mean something, with a simple notification to the FCC. Some broadcasters had requested the increases way back in 2008. HD stations had previously been allowed to broadcast at a maximum of 1% of analog power. Now, that's efficiency, but that apparently is not enough, but apparently they don't want to do any more. Doyle said he was disappointed. Doyle at the FCC said he was disappointed by the slow response, but hoped the number would increase over time. Well, doesn't everything? I mean, that's an easy one. You get that one. You get that one for free, Mr. Doyle. And, on a related subject, plans for a special London Olympics radio station to broadcast in London during the 2012 Games have been scrapped. The media regulator over there, the equivalent of the FCC, they're called Ofcom, pulled the plug on the project, which would have broadcast on digital radio only. Because of a lack of interest. Are you seeing a trend here, ladies and gentlemen? Ofcom said it had expected demand for new radio services to be particularly high during the Olympics and Paralympics. They have to include that, or else they get sued. But it ruled out the possibility of short-term station transmissions being available on analog AM or FM, like, you know, what people listen to, and therefore making it available to a much wider audience because of a lack of analog spectrum. The regulator said it received just 10 responses to its appeal for preliminary expressions of interest, a number of which were not suitable. I'd like to hear those stations. And did not meet the digital-only requirements. So if you want to broadcast in digital, go right ahead. Because apparently you'll be talking to you. You'll be like me. I'm me talking to me. And now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the State Department's inspector general says bomb-sniffing dogs in Afghanistan and Iraq aren't being tested properly and may not be able to effectively detect explosives. Well, aside from that, I guess they're working out really well. Isn't that really what you want bomb-sniffing dogs to do? Really, when you stop to think about it? The Inspector General's review found that the companies hired to supply and train the animals weren't testing them for all the scents of the most commonly encountered explosives, increasing the chance of a dog missing a bomb in a vehicle or luggage. That puts U.S. diplomats at risk, according to the Inspector General of the State Department. The companies are U.S. Training Center, a business unit of the company formerly known as Blackwater, ding, 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 and Ronco Consulting Corporation in Washington. Really? Ronco? Vegematic Ronco? I don't think so. They also used expired or potentially contaminated materials for the scent tests, said the IG. Representatives from Ronco, owned by Wackenhut Services, and the U.S. Training Center did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Inspector General's report. but they're putting the whack in Whackin' Hut, I'm sure they're going to say. The Inspector General's review was limited to those three canine programs handled by those companies. The report does not say how many dogs each contractor provides. Overall, the State Department uses nearly 200 bomb-sniffing dogs. Why don't we use them at airports? Why mess around? I mean, forget these dogs because they're not trained, but you know what I'm saying? Dogs. And the report only offers a glimpse of the cost of these services, saying the State Department pays $24 million a year alone for canine services at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Still, you know how many full-body scanners that could buy? Not that many. The report faults the department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security, responsible for managing the canine program, for weak oversight. Investigators found that the contractors, not the Bureau, were running the program and policing themselves. That doesn't happen anywhere else in today's federal government, does it? During visits to Afghanistan and Iraq, the investigators did not meet any Bureau personnel with experience or expertise in bomb-sniffing dogs. Bomb-sniffing cats? No, not neither. They depended upon the knowledge and expertise of the contractors to ensure all contractual requirements and other standards were met, said the report. And the contractors told investigators that no outside organization with expertise in explosive detection canines has ever reviewed their operations in Iraq or Afghanistan. Security, ladies and gentlemen, it is our number 741 job. But please take off your shoes. And a Treasury program to take toxic assets. Remember those off bank balance sheets? The program was plagued by inconsistency. This is a report from the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, Neil Borofsky. The program to take toxic assets off the bank balance sheets, which was part of the TARP program, was known as the Legacy Securities Public-Private Investment Partnership, or PPIP. PPIP to you, sir. They eventually selected nine firms that raised some $30 billion from investors and the government to acquire troubled assets. You know, those stinky mortgage securities. Eight of the nine firms, led by giants Invesco, BlackRock, and AllianceBernstein, continue to manage and invest funds largely in residential real estate-backed securities. Borofsky says the government's plan for selecting asset managers was well-conceived, but could have been carried out better. While Treasury designed and adequately documented a reasonable selection process, the implementation of that process is vulnerable to criticism, he says. He takes issue with how Treasury communicated the criteria it would consider in selecting asset managers and for failing to explain how it would actually weigh the factors. The department's shifting views caused uncertainty and confusion among possible applicants. Treasury then reconsidered its approach, adding a new requirement that the applicant demonstrated an ability to manage at least $1 billion in assets, but it didn't tell anybody it had done that. The change had the effect of secretly slimming the pool of possible managers by 40%. A slimming pool. Hey, gals. A recommendation that applicants have at least $10 billion of real estate real estate securities under management risked unnecessarily discouraging applications from smaller asset managers, said the Inspector General. It probably ended up being unnecessary to boot. The Treasury's failed to clarify expectations for minority-owned firms brought on to act as partners to the big asset managers, with the result that just two such firms ended up playing a role in the process. One ended up playing no apparent role in the program whatsoever. The so-called PPIP, was launched with much fanfare last year at the height of the banking crisis. Treasury initially billed it as creating as much as $1 trillion in toxic asset purchasing power, and the plan was duly criticized as a giveaway to bankers. But neither of those predictions came to pass. PPIP now rates barely a footnote in any account of the various programs the government had to deal with the financial crisis. The program's ultimate goals to restore the health of the financial sector and get loans flowing again remain unmet. TARP expired last week. And, of course, one of the early things they did was change the name from toxic assets to troubled assets.
MBAs. For so long, we raked in bucks and praise.
cooking up the stew where you now praise troubled assets. Good as gold, that's what everyone was told about the paper crap we sold. Troubled, troubled assets. Yeah, they're troubled, like champagne that's underbubbled. For short, we call them toxics. They fell to earth, landed on their coccyx. Bad home loans, not much more than skin and bones, spread worldwide like mobile phones. Troubled assets. Funny paper, fine as gruel and strong as vapor. Triple A rated. One thing it can't do, be evaluated. Who will buy certificates piled to the sky? All we did was shrink the pie. Troubled assets. Troubled, troubled assets.
Troubled, troubled
assets. Troubled, troubled assets.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap. It's too clean to be safe to meter with the cheap and the safe and the clean. It's nuclear power. The stimulus package was promoted to help grow a new clean energy economy. But the U.S. Energy Department spent a large chunk of stimulus money trying to clean up the radioactive mess from the Cold War. $6 billion, nearly 20% of its stimulus budget, went to clean and decontaminate nuclear waste sites across the country, chief recipients the Savannah River site in South Carolina and the Hanford site in Washington. The department allocated a total of $3.5 billion to Savannah and Hanford, and created or salvaged about 6,100 jobs as a result. We were looking at specific activities that would create jobs, shovel-ready projects that were focused on decommissioning and decontamination, says the Energy Department's assistant secretary. Not green jobs. Green jobs. Well, that's a secret you're keeping. For 32 years, the nuclear industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have failed to agree on a plan for fixing clog-prone containment sumps at 37 of America's 104 civilian nuclear plants. This according to the Toledo Blade. Those sumps are an important part of a plant's emergency core cooling system. That's a collection of devices to shut down the reactor and avoid a catastrophic nuclear meltdown in the event of a major accident. That's all. There's a 1978 letter from then Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chairman Joe Hendry to President Carter, citing the problem, one of the federal government's earliest known references to it. The Regulatory Commission has reaffirmed several times since then that sumps at certain plants have been at risk of becoming overwhelmed by paint chips, insulation, and other free-floating debris that would form if an accident occurred. If those sumps failed, there wouldn't be anything recirculating water to cool the reactors. But don't worry. No, I don't know why don't worry. I just said that. That was me, not Christina. No. Regulatory Commission Chairman Gregory B. Jaxo acknowledged this week the agency has been grappling with this issue for quite some time now. More than 18 years elapsed before regulators finally showed signs of getting serious about it in September of 1996. Then they began drawing up plans for what's known as Generic Safety Issue 191. That's an industry-wide requirement to make the long-overdue sump fixes. Since then, another 14 years have passed. NRC spokesman Scott Burnell said in an email to the Toledo Blade that the, quote, overall risk from this issue was low to begin with, unquote. But a longtime nuclear safety engineer for the Union of Concerned Scientists and a former NRC employee, David Lochbaum, says the Challenger and Columbia shuttle disasters plus BP spill are, quote, other low probability, high consequence events, unquote, much like 9/11, Chernobyl, and the failure of a certain hurricane protection system. It was supposed to be good. It's tempting to view a potential accident of very low probability and not justify taking steps to fix it rapidly, says Lockbaum. JAXA says a resolution to the generic problem nationwide has proven to be a Herculean task. This is an example, he said, he's at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, of the quintessential safety issues that are at the heart of our mission. It is critical that the commission provide clear direction to the staff on how to resolve this issue in a timely manner. 3 decades and counting, ladies and gentlemen. So, timely, a federal audit set to be released this week calls for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to improve nuclear power plant security and pant security, while we're at it, please, against infiltration by potential terrorists. The NRC's Inspector General was asked by a senator to do the audit after a suspected Al-Qaeda member, Sharif Mobley, was found to have worked in a New Jersey nuclear power plant for 6 years. The audit recommends additional training in identifying suspected terrorists, greater access to criminal databases by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, stepped-up rescreening of power plant employees, and notifying plant operators of foreign travel. Those are such good ideas, don't you think? The recommendations must be acted upon within 30 days. The suspect is now in Yemen. He had passed criminal background checks and worked at several nuclear power plants without incident. There's no indication his work had any connection to his alleged involvement with terror groups. It's fine. He's in Yemen now. What could happen in Yemen? And after visiting a nuclear power plant in eastern France, an international team led by the UN IAEA has made recommendations on how to reinforce French nuclear safety practices. Let's not be like the French, ladies and gentlemen. The team acknowledged that the plant had good practices, including safety guidelines for outages and use of remote video, but areas which could be improved are improving the effective control of contamination. Check. That would be good. And what could be contaminated? How could you it's so... And limiting access to the main control room to only necessary personnel. Hey, what are you doing in there? Can I push this? A federal safety panel has warned that a key facility for cleaning up the nation's most dangerous nuclear weapons waste at Hanford must not be commissioned until technical issues are resolved. A learn-as-we-go philosophy does not seem prudent for this facility, says the chairman, Peter Winokur. This is a board that oversees nuclear safety at weapons sites. That's a good idea. Constellation Energy, a private company, said it had reached an impasse in negotiations for a federal loan guarantee to build a proposed third nuclear plant near Washington. The decision would appear to kill the project. The Office of Management and Budget was seeking a fee of $880 million on a guarantee. We're going to guarantee $7.8 billion, we the taxpayers. Constellation says that would doom the project, or the economics of any nuclear project, for that matter. The fee is to compensate taxpayers for the risk of default. The company argues that because the plant's model is being proven in Finland, France, and China, the fee should be much lower. The project had once been hailed as a cornerstone of a nuclear power renaissance. But nobody looked up what the renaissance was. Vermont Yankee nuclear plants owners have changed their plans for handling radioactive groundwater collected following a tritium leak. Entergy Nuclear originally planned to use the water in operations of the plant on site after treating it. Now what are they going to do with the water? Truck it to Tennessee. Get it out of Vermont. They'll ship 300,000 gallons of water to Tennessee. Yeah, we'll take you crappy water. We'll take your contaminated, tritiated water. Sure. What are they going to do within Tennessee? Not known. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has found significant safety problems at Omaha Public Power District's Ford Calhoun nuclear plant. There are inadequacies in the flood protection strategy for the plant, which just happens to be located along the Missouri River. The problems were found in an inspection of the plant earlier this year. Inspectors reported the flood plan, should the Missouri threaten the plant, included installing floodgates in front of the doors of the auxiliary building and then pile sandbags on top of them. The utility did have a stockpile of sandbags, but didn't have the sand necessary to fill them, you see, ladies and gentlemen. It's clean, it's cheap, it's safe. Just get us some sand. Maybe they got some in Tennessee.
Nice. The seamless segue.
This is the show. I'm not you. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
And I did dabble in witchcraft, into witchcraft. Warlock craft, actually. No, I didn't. Didn't dabble at all. I'm not a dabbler. Are you? Because I'm you. No, I'm not. I'm me. I got to focus on me. Deadline New Delhi. An Australian wrestler has apologized after he was stripped of a silver medal for making a rude gesture to judges during a Commonwealth Games wrestling final. This is that kind of mini Olympics that almost wasn't ready because the accommodations for the athletes, I believe the operative word was stank. Australian team spokesman John Gatfield says Haseen Ferkiri met with and apologized to his Indian opponent and officials. The official confirmed that a written apology had also been sent. Ferkiri had raised his finger at officials after being disqualified from the Greco-Roman final. He also refused to shake hands with his opponent, which led officials to strip him of the silver medal. Ichiro Ozawa, the Japanese ruling party politician who last month lost a bid to become prime minister, faces indictment for violating campaign finance laws. They have those in Japan, you see. After a judicial panel ruled he must be charged. Ozawa said in a statement, "I apologize from the bottom of my heart for causing troubles with regard to my political funded group. I'm certain that my innocence will become clear in the trial."
Sorry.
That's right. He apologized for being innocent. NATO apologized several times. Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a letter released Thursday by the U.S. Embassy for the drone attack, which killed or wounded six Pakistani soldiers. That followed two other U.S. apologies issued Wednesday, nearly a week after the strike, acknowledging that two of the American military's Afghanistan-based assault helicopters had entered Pakistani airspace several times and mistakenly fired at a military post. Dateline New Zealand. TV New Zealand breakfast presenter Paul Henry apologized on live television and said he was wrong to say that Governor General Anand Satyanand didn't look or sound like a real New Zealander. "Is he even a New Zealander?" Henry asked. "Are you going to choose a New Zealander who looks and sounds like a New Zealander this time?" He said in some accent that cannot be identified. Chief Executive Rick Ellis said Henry's remarks were inappropriate for anyone in the company to make. And as editor-in-chief, I have today suspended Paul without pay. When Sir Anand returns from the Commonwealth Games, I will personally apologize to him, said the head of TVNZ. But that's not all. Same guy resulted in the India summoning the New Zealand ambassador to complain over the insensitive and vulgar comments from that breakfast television host who ridiculed the name of Delhi's chief minister. Paul Henry caused an outcry when he burst into fits of laughter while saying the name of the chief minister, pronounced Dixit, but spelled with an H in an unfortunate place for English speakers. The New Zealand High Commissioner apologized for that, too. And speaking of broadcast apologies, Suzanne Sanchez, who's married to former CNN newscaster Rick Sanchez, noted on her Facebook page that her husband had made amends, not anons, but amends with Jon Stewart after calling him a bigot. "Rick apologized to Jon Stewart today," said Mrs. Sanchez. "They had a good talk." And then Sanchez publicly apologized in a media tour later in the week. A week after the New Jersey Jewish Standard's September 24th publication of a wedding announcement for a gay couple, the Teaneck, New Jersey-based weekly apologized and promised it wouldn't happen again. Now, it's apologizing for its apology. The paper's original action was taken in response to outrage expressed by some local Orthodox rabbis. Online reaction to the apology prompted the retraction. The White House apologized on Thursday after a number of foreign diplomats were turned away from a glittering diplomatic reception because of a security snafu. President and First Lady hosted the high-powered networking session in the ornate East Room. But a number of ambassadors were held up outside the reception as their names and dates of birth apparently became mixed up in the computer system used by the Secret Service. There was information that was inputted incorrectly, said the White House spokesperson. Among those ambassadors discomfited was the Pakistani ambassador. Maybe there is such a thing as karma. Who knows? I don't know, and I'm not you. British journalist, BBC journalist Andrew Marr has apologized to drivers after a truck carrying 15 tons of his latest book overturned, blocking a road. I was going to mention the name of the book, but the moment passed. Presbyterian Church USA leaders formally apologized this week to 30 people who they determined were sexually or physically abused in mission programs overseas, most of whom were children of missionaries serving across Africa and Asia between 1950 and 1990. The apologies came with the release of a 546-page report that followed nearly 7 years of investigation of abuse in mission programs. It found cases of sexual abuse perpetrated on 14 victims in Cameroon, 5 in Congo, 3 in Ethiopia, 7 in Thailand, and 1 case of physical abuse in Pakistan. To those who were abused, we offer our deepest apologies, says Linda Valentine, executive director of the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly Mission Council. A Japanese cabinet minister apologized this week for posing inside Parliament for a high-fashion photograph spread that opposition conservatives criticized as extravagant and a possible breach of the rules. If the location of the photo shoot was inappropriate or has caused concerns, that was not my intention, said Government Revitalization Minister Renho, who wore designer dresses in photos taken inside the Diet Building this summer. I apologize straightforwardly, Renho added. Fashion shoot inside a diet. The diet. Go figure. The Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's Police apologized this week to an elderly couple hours after some 24 gun-toting officers burst into their southwest side home late at night in a mistaken search for drugs and guns. This is your war on drugs on brain. Your brain on... Anna Jackie Meck was just going to bed. She's 84. Thursday night when the heavily armed officers broke through the back and front doors at their modest bungalow. Her ailing husband, Andre, 89, had already been in bed for hours. They were terrified, according to their son, by what they thought was a home invasion. Deputy Sheriff, yes, Mike Smith, delivered a personal apology to the family. The son said, I think the most potent drug they have is aspirin. Dateline Asheville, North Carolina, a Bible reading at a recent police department employee meeting raised some concerns, prompting Police Chief Bill Hogan to apologize. The Gideons, who place Bibles in hotel rooms, asked the police department if it could offer Bibles to department employees. Hogan was not present at the meeting, but it's his understanding that a Gideon representative not only offered the Bibles, but quoted from the Bible. The former president of a small community bank earned the distinction of being the first person convicted of ripping off the federal bailout program. He pled guilty Friday to fraud charges, admitting he tried to grab more than $11 million in taxpayer rescue funds. Charles Antonucci was contrite and agreed to pay $11 million and forfeit various assets to the government. He agreed he accepted bribes to influence his decisions. For these acts, I offer no excuse. I know what I was doing was wrong, and I apologize to those I hurt financially, which means you and me. Jonathan Franzen's British publisher has apologized for a printing error that left dozens of spelling and punctuation mistakes in the first edition of his new novel. Bolivian President Evo Morales apologized for kneeing an opponent in the groin during a weekend soccer match. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has apologized to Britons for not announcing the planned cut in child support when he was running for office instead of waiting until after he won. Late Show host David Letterman apologized to Rachel Ray for apparently acting like a jerk. There's something wrong with me, and he said in an on-air apology. I'm just nuts. So if you see Rachel, tell her I'm sorry. She didn't do anything wrong. There really is something wrong with me, said Letterman. I really don't know what it is, and I'm seeking professional help. Rachel, I'm very sorry. I got carried away. I'll admit you had every reason to be alarmed. I'm so sorry. This is because he had skewered her for having so many shows devoted to food when the rest of the world was starving. The Swedish hospital. Forget the Swedish hospital. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, copyright feature of this broadcast. Now, you know that the bunch of major banks, including starting off with GMAC Bank, which we, that is to say, we taxpayers own, and we in the TARP deal thing. And they have now suspended foreclosures, GMAC's unit, which does business under the name of Ally Bank. You may have seen their commercials. Anyway, they suspended foreclosures this week. Bank of America suspended foreclosures in every state it does business in now. Because apparently all these foreclosure motions have been unsupported by appropriate documentation. Perhaps the case of the one person who was signing 1,000 foreclosure notices a day, which require him to verify that he has seen the underlying documentation and can swear that it's accurate and complete. Notarizations have been missing. The underlying documentation has been missing in many cases, the actual notes. And, of course, this is a result of the mortgages being sliced and diced into a million pieces to be securitized, don't you know? Doesn't that make you feel better? They're securitized. As I say, it all started with the GMAC unit, which is part of this now mainly government-owned company called Ally, or something similar.
Would you like a house?
Okay.
Here you go.
Hmm.
Big enough?
It's very big.
It's yours.
Really?
Sure. Just as long as you... Oh, oops. You didn't keep up with the payments.
What payments?
Uh-oh. Somebody didn't read the fine print.
I didn't see any.
Now we're gonna have to foreclose. Give me the house.
I want the house. It's mine.
Ask your little friend here. He signed the foreclosure form.
You did?
Yep. He's the notary. He signed 1,000 of them just this morning.
You're not a notary.
Sure am.
Even kids know this is no way to treat a trusted borrower whose loan we sliced into 14 different pieces and sold to investors on 3 continents. That's why we're different from the other banks. At Ally Bank, we're worse. Our foreclosure forms wouldn't fool a kid. Luckily, they don't have to. It may not be the right thing to do, but it's just the thing we do. Ally Bank, we're in the gutter with you. Member FDIC.
talking if my mind ain't worked at all. Better to let people think you're dumb than to speak and remove all doubt. And I've no plans to be wearing out your welcome mat. You know I never want to make you sorry. Not too big on that. Not too big on Junior. Big on that.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. This is a cute one. A U.S. terror alert this week about Al-Qaeda plans to target attacks or to attack targets in Western Europe was politically motivated and not based on credible new information. The Guardian of London reports that senior Pakistani diplomats and European intelligence officials have said that to the paper. The warning, which led Britain, France, and other countries to raise their overseas terror alert levels despite its vagueness, was an attempt to justify a recent escalation in U.S. drone and helicopter attacks inside Pakistan that have set the country on fire, according to Pakistan's High Commissioner in Britain. That High Commissioner, Wajid Hassan, is close to Pakistan's president. He suggested the Obama administration was playing politics with the terror threat before next month's midterm elections. And he's claimed that President Obama is reacting to pressure to demonstrate that his Afghan war strategy and the troop surge were necessary. Our friend, Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen. And that's news from outside the bubble, a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Big talk this weekend about the departure of General James Jones as head of the National Security Council and his replacement by Tom Donilon. I don't know. You tell me. I'm you. My only question is, can we get somebody in there who knows a little something about the history of Afghanistan? I just remember that all the smart people during the Vietnam War knew everything about everything except the history of Vietnam. Just one little thing, you know? History. It's like toast. By the way, speaking of foreclosures, it's obvious that we're now in a foreclosure bubble, so enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, over the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet, on your computer at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Available as on your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it would be just like filling your sandbags with sand if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast and the music heard here on, you'll find them if you look at harryshearer.com. And if you want to know where you can find The Big Uneasy, documentary film about why New Orleans flooded, yes, I can say it. It'll be at the New Orleans Film Festival October 21st. Information about the film is available at thebiguneasy.com, including all the documentation behind it and in front of it. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO. We're making her famous. At least Facebook famous. That's famous, isn't it? Facebook famous? I don't know. You tell me. Because I'm me. I dabbled in meatcraft. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.